This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Interfacing complete. Please stand by. Now downloading Tech Talk Radio with Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ. Tech Talk Radio, it's technology you can understand. And now, here are Dr. Richard Schertz and Jim Russ.
Good morning and welcome to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. It is Saturday, April the 30th, and you're listening to the best of Tech Talk. The doc is away. This is his trusty sidekick, Jim Russ, with another edition of the best of Tech Talk on Federal News Radio. And we start, as we always do, with a dive into the mailbag.
Now, it is time for...
Whoops, no, it's not time for that.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Have you...
Hold I had things out of order
listen,
over here. I
listen,
had a,
Jim. Had they're a, not supposed to know that we do polka dancing on the breaks here.
Okay. Hey, I will let our listeners go first, but I have a question for you when you're finished with the mailbag.
Okay,
is that okay?
Yeah, you
All
can
right,
do that.
Cool.
All okay. Right. What? Now it is time for.
Now he's gone. You play it and it goes away.
Okay. Let's try it one more
again.
Time. Let's see if he's still doing polka dancing. Now it is time for.
There's a letter in your mailbox.
Okay.
All right. That's good.
You know, Mr. Big Voice has got to quit taking dancing lessons in the next room.
The great thing about this is you never know what's going to happen on Tech Talk.
I know. It's you'd think that we'd have the technology under control, you would think that, but it's not good. Now we have a comment on the face. On the Tech Talk Online Facebook page from Ronald Glassford. You know, you go to Facebook Tech Talk Online. We have a page where you can suggest topics.
Mm-hmm.
And Ronald said, "Hello, Tech Talk Radio. I listen to your broadcast and enjoy the show very much. I'm surprised but happy to be the first post on your Facebook page. I would love to win a meal in your award-winning dining room, but being in Northern Ontario, Canada, the free meal would be very expensive for me."
It wouldn't be anywhere near free.
Yeah. Since you're looking for new topics, I wondered if you could talk about the Android operating system for tablets. I was going to buy the iPad at Christmas, but I thought it would hold off, and so... this is the perfect question for this week, and in fact, what I'm going to do later in the show, I'm going to talk about the Honeycomb operating system, which is specifically for the tablet or the iPad competitor, and so
mm-hmm.
we'll give you all that information just a little bit later in the show. Now we got an email from Lauren. Dear Dr. I want to say one more thing. Why don't we have any Facebook entries from local people? Why is it people from Ontario, Canada go to the Tech Talk Online Facebook page?
Well,
I want comments from local people as well as international people.
I think the problem is that the people here locally take us for granted.
Yeah,
when you get
outside
the area, you're kind of a treasure, I think.
Yeah.
That's why you have so many people listening in China and India.
I've got so many listeners in India. I'm like a rock star in India. In the U.S.? Oh, yeah.
Not
Tech
so much.
Talk. No. What is that?
No, not so much. But
okay, I've got an email from Lauren. Dear Dr. Schertz, why is it when I go to YouTube and try to watch videos, many of the videos have significant pauses and stops during the viewing?
Ooh.
Sometimes I can't even, stand to watch the movie. What's causing this? Is there something wrong with my laptop, or is there something wrong with the YouTube site? Thanks, Lauren in Bethesda. Well, Lauren, it's neither your laptop nor the YouTube site. It's your internet service provider. You don't have enough bandwidth.
Uh-huh.
And what happens is that, bandwidth is given in bits per second, like you have 256 kilobits per second.
Mm-hmm.
If, for instance, that video is streaming down at 512 kilobits per second, there's not enough bit rate in your pipe for it to stream down, and so what it does, it has to stop, it buffers for a while, stores up some video, and then plays it until it runs out of video, and then it has to store it up again. So you have a choice. Either you can get a higher speed internet service connection, which would probably be paying more money. I got Fios, and it's like super fast, so... But it's more expensive. You could do that, or you could look at the low resolution YouTubes. Just normally they have an HD YouTube and a low resolution YouTube. So go to the. You normally have a choice, which which fidelity you want to look at. So pick the lowest resolution that you can, and then you might be able to do that without without having it buffering and without having the breaks. For instance, when we upload the audio for the show, after the show we upload an MP3 file, we actually resampled it at 32 kilobits per second. It's taken off the air at 128 kilobits per second. I resample it at 32 kilobits per second so that you can listen to the Tech Talk radio on a dial-up, which only be about 54 kilobits per second, because I've got a lot of folks in other countries that only have dial-up, and I'd like them to get the get Tech Talk in its pure fidelity without all of the all the buffering. And so we've just down-selected it to sort of match the size of the pipe. But with YouTube video, you've got a lot more bandwidth requirement than that.
Yep.
Okay, we have an email from Alan. Dear Tech Talk, I have my own website, and should I include www when linking to my website? I've noticed, you know, I could have www.allen.org, or I could have allen.org. What should I use? Well, let's go back kind of the history of this. Most sites allow both options, actually. In the case of the Stratford site, we've set up the domain name server to set up www.stratford.edu to go to the IP address of the web server, as well as stratford.edu. So you can put in either with or without the three W's, and it will work. But we've configured the domain name server for that. Now, where this originally came from, it used to be that you'd have a domain with multiple servers on the domain. And if it was www.domainname, it would go to the web server. If it was mail.domainname, it would go to the mail server. Mm-hmm. If it was ftp.domainname, it would go to a file storage server. And so the prefix was designed to tell it which server to go to. But over the years, people just got lazy, and they said, look, why don't we just let the thing that's not declared as web, in other words, without any prefix, without the three W's or anything, let's just let that go to the website so people can just type a shorter domain name. So that's probably how you should do it. But when you quote your website, I'd always quote it with www.allen.org so that people know it's a website. And then if they're lazy, they can just skip the three W's.
Gotcha.
Email from Alan. Eileen.
Well,
sorry,
third
Eileen.
Time's a charm.
Eileen, I'm so sorry, Eileen, that I messed up your name, but I'll try to do better next time. I'm giving away my computer.
Hello.
How can I clean off all personal information and software before giving it away? Thanks, Eileen. Well, that's actually, you can do that, but it's somewhat of a project, and depending on how secure you want it to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you're going to give it away to some spy organization, there's all sorts of tools to reconstruct it. You've got to be more careful than just give it away to the casual user.
Right.
Basically, if you want to do it without the super complexity, you want to just basically delete and uninstall as much as you can. Now, first of all, delete all your data files. Now, usually the data files are in My Documents. So go to My Documents, delete all those files. Now, sometimes people end up, like, randomly storing data files all over the place, you know, because they get a little confused.
Mm-hmm.
So you might have some on the desktop. You may want to look around. You might want to do a search for .doc or if you want to look at any document files, you might want to search for them. But you want to delete all the document files you can find. Then you want to remove the programs, which you're, of course, not giving the license to. So you go to the Add Remove program, and then you remove the program. Go to Add Remove on the control panel, since you didn't say, I'm assuming you had Windows, and then you just start uninstalling from the Add Remove. And then what you want to do, you remove all users except the administrative account. Maybe you've got a user account, you've got a guest account, and all these user accounts have data which is stored with them. So you delete all the user accounts and just leave the administrator account. That's going to clean up a lot of files that were specific to each one of the users. Then you want to clean up the disk, and you can do a disk cleanup utility, which is within Windows. It'll clean up and get rid of anything that is not there. But I would use CC Cleaner, which actually will clean everything up. You can also wipe the disk. There's called an S delete, which is secure erase. It will go in and erase everything, which is all. It'll erase all the empty space. See, the problem is that when you delete a file, the empty space, it doesn't delete the data, it just deletes the index.
Right.
So if you do a a secure erase that actually goes in and it overwrites all of that empty space, allegedly empty space, multiple times so it can't be reconstructed. Otherwise, somebody can use an undelete program and get it back. Now, there's also some additional data, which is in System Restore.
Yep.
So you want to turn off System Restore. There's also additional data in the hibernation mode. It'll go into hibernation mode. It kind of stores it. So you want to turn off hibernation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's also some paging files, which sometimes you will swap out data to your hard drive. So you want to set your virtual memory to zero and delete the paging files. This is when you're... When it runs out of RAM, it basically pages data onto the hard drive. I mean, these are all places where it could be hidden. After you do all that, then, as I said, you do the secure delete. Now, that's just a lot of work. A lot of people just say to heck with it, and they just delete the whole hard drive and reinstall the operating system.
They just
basically delete everything. Then they basically reformat it. Then they use secure delete, and then they reinstall the operating system. Either way works.
That might be the safest way. That's really the way to really make sure that everything's gone.
Yeah, it's probably the safest way. But it is quite a big project when you want to give it. And a lot of people, you know, sometimes in the old days, I would help students go down and buy used computers down at the computer warehouse. They get some good deals down there frequently. And it's surprising the stuff that you find on the hard drive sometimes. People just don't actually take it all away, and the stuff's there that you shouldn't be there.
Yep. I have a question for you. My daughter has an iPad, and we've noticed that there are two different rates at which this thing will charge. If you plug it into the wall charger, it takes a lot longer than plugging it into the USB port and plugging it into another computer and charging it that way.
Really?
Have you heard of this? Is there a reason for that you could think of?
I mean, it's a different voltage. Probably your USB port has a higher voltage than the charger. You have the correct charger for the unit.
I believe so.
You didn't, because the chargers are all in different, different voltages.
I'll have to check that part of it out. But she'll plug it in at night into the wall, and it'll go from 30% to 50% overnight. It won't fully charge.
Okay.
Using off the USB port, she'll get more of a charge, but it still won't fully charge. This is a brand new iPad. The battery can't be going bad.
It could be a battery problem.
Could it really?
Could be a battery problem. If it doesn't fully charge. Now, see, I've got an old computer on my USB port, which is a lower voltage, and I can't charge my cell phone on that USB port because the voltage is too low.
Really?
And the newer USB ports, which can support more power, have a higher voltage. So I think there's a voltage difference.
I have a funny feeling. Could it also be that if they got this thing new, when you get a new device, there's a way to get the battery to the first time you use it.
First time you use it. And so I would let her, maybe she should totally discharge it first.
Right.
Let completely discharge it.
And then let it charge all the way back up.
And let it charge all the way up.
Before they use it again.
Yeah. I mean, because if you never let it discharge, sometimes the battery ages a little quicker, but it shouldn't be that old.
No, it's brand new. I mean, they got this thing over Christmas.
I'd take it back and ask if there's a defective battery. Maybe there's
the battery in the iPad?
No,
of course not.
No,
this is why I have iSquat. I have no i anything.
No, what you do is you take it back. Maybe there was a recall on that particular battery that they know about, and they'll fix it.
Interesting. Good idea.
That's what I would do.
Listen to that. I get this for free, guys. You can, too. How can people send us an email if they got a question, Doc?
If you want to talk to us, by email, send us an email at techtalk@stratford.edu, and that email will get forwarded right to me, and we'll pick it up on one of the next shows.
That's right. You can get it for free here on Tech Talk, heard on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2, online at techtalkonline.com. Learn more about our sponsors, Stratford University, by going to stratford.edu. This is Tech Talk. We'll be right back right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different. With campuses in Tysons Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed. Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. It's a little empty in here today. It's a little lonely. Just me and the panel walls. But even though the doc is away, it is still time for...
Profiles in IT.
We're talking about Douglas C. Engelbart.
An obscure name, but he's come up with something at our fingertips, right?
He is best known for inventing the computer mouse and the graphical user interface. And no, he didn't work for Apple. Engelbart received his bachelor's degree in electrical engineering from Oregon State in 1948 and a bachelor in engineering from UC Berkeley in 1952 and a PhD in electronics from UC Berkeley in 1955. He stayed on at Berkeley as an assistant professor for about a year, but left a year later to join the Stanford Research Institute because he just couldn't really follow all those rules of working for a university. He's kind of a researcher at heart. Now, he was actually influenced. He was sort of a hippie technologist in a way. He wanted to use technology to solve the world's problems. He was influenced by something which he called linguistic relativity, that says language controls how sophisticated thoughts can be, how sophisticated the thoughts that you can express can be expressed. So language actually impacts thoughts. He then further reasoned that the state of technology or the accessibility of technology controls our ability to manipulate information and our ability to develop new technologies. And so he was focused on using technology to help augment human intelligence. His philosophy was summarized in 1962 in a paper which was written under government contract, Augmenting Human Intellect, a Conceptual Framework, published in 1962. He founded the Augmentation Laboratory at Stanford Research Institute shortly after he went to SRI. While he was there, because he was trying to make data and computers accessible to just individuals, his team developed computer interface elements such as bitmapped screens that allow you to have like fancy looking fonts. You know, so the idea of having really fancy looking fonts that were laid out. He developed groupware, which allowed people to interact, in other words, to get collective intelligence going. His group developed hypertext. Now, hypertext is really what went into the browser, what Tim Berners-Lee developed when he developed the World Wide Web all the way back in 1994. They were actually coming up with hypertext concepts then. All of these were precursors to the graphical interface that we know and love. In 1970, he received a patent for the XY position indicator for a display system. Now, he applied for that patent in 87. He received it in 1970. He called that XY position indicator a mouse.
Wow. The trash can falls over for dramatic interlude there.
No, that was a mouse. I think
it's a real mouse.
A mouse just fell into the trash can.
I think you're possibly right.
And so he never received any royalties for the mouse invention.
This is always our question. Did he get rich?
Some years later, he learned that SRI, without him knowing it, licensed the mouse to Apple for $40,000. Now, it also, because he applied for the patent in 1967, it expired in 1987. And remember, the Macintosh and all the PCs started coming out around 1985. So about the time that the individual PCs hit, his patent was dead. His version, he also came up with the concept of Windows, but at that time, software was not patentable, so he could not patent the idea of Windows.
So he was a man way ahead of his time, to his own detriment.
We're talking about, these are in the 70s, and the personal computer didn't come out until 1985.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he was like far ahead. In 1968, he staged a public demonstration of his network computer system, which he held at the Augmentation Research Center. And this was the first public appearance of the mouse, Windows, hypermedia with object linking and addressing, and video teleconferencing. He called this an online system, or NLS, in 1968.
Why did this not catch on then?
The PC
it wasn't portable enough for people to use it everywhere.
It wasn't portable enough. I mean, it preceded the tremendous explosion of the integrated circuit, the CPU.
So we're still talking about computers the size of a Chevy van, basically.
Big system. So he was always thinking in terms of client server operation. We got a big server, a networked kind of system. He actually, in 1969, his Augmentation Research Center became the second node in the ARPANET, which was the precursor of the Internet. That was node number two of the ARPANET. Now, several of Engelbart's best researchers became alienated with him.
The ARPANET dog in the studio.
Oh, yeah. Several of his researchers kind of got fed up with him because he was actually kind of a hard guy to work with, because his vision was to connect the world with networks and use collective wisdom to solve the social problems. You got to realize this is the peak of the hippie culture. 68, we had all this is all Berkeley. Mm-hmm. We had all of the war protesters. So he wanted to solve the world's problems with computer networking. And, his group, research group, some of them got fed up with him. And they left because they thought the future wasn't in network computers, but rather it was in individual PCs. And we now know they were kind of both right.
Right.
We went to individual PCs, now we're back to the network as being... in a way, he was vindicated. So 13 of his people left, and they went to work for Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, working on, and they ported with them all of the ideas about the graphical user interface and the mouse and everything. Apple Computer swiped all of the technology from Palo Alto Research Center, and that was then built into the Macintosh. If you look at the first mouse that Engelbart came up with, it was a square wooden box with two wheels underneath it. I should have brought a picture in to show the webcam, mm-hmm. but I failed to do that. And the first
Naveed, get the crayons out and start making a picture, would you? You know what it looks like.
What were the dimensions of it?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, that would be about 4 inches on a side. It was mm-hmm. like a 4-inch cube, and the wheels were about 2.5 inches. He had two wheels at 90 degrees, and he was holding this big 4-inch cube block and rolling it around on the desk.
That's pretty funny.
The first Macintosh mouse was square. Because, of course, it was based on
a grid,
his mouse. It was based on his mouse.
Mm-hmm.
So the first Macintosh mouse was square.
That's funny.
And now they eventually decided.
They're much more ergonomically.
They're more ergonomic. Now, he continued to be at the Augmentation Research Center until 78, when it was closed down for lack of funding. So I think maybe they decided they couldn't save the world. I mean, he sort of went off on a tangent. Hit NLS, which was his network operating system, then became the principal line of business for Timeshare, which was the office automation division. Timeshare didn't do so well. It was eventually sold to McDonnell Douglas, and in the end, McDonnell Douglas just terminated Engelbart. So, in the end, it's kind of a
from the 60s hippie culture to McDonnell Douglas.
Yeah, it's kind of a set. Now, 1995. This was the year after. The year after the web really hit, the World Wide Web, and it was clear at that point that his vision of hypertext and linked computers, his vision was actually correct. The vision, in 1995, people recognized his vision was right. This was the vision that he had in 1970.
Yeah.
You see?
Can you imagine if he had waited for the technology to get there, and then he invented the mouse and could patent it, how much money he would have made?
I know. So in 25 years after his innovative thinking, he was the first recipient of the Yuri Rubinsky Memorial Award, which basically made it clear that he was one of the leaders in Internet technology. In 1997, he's awarded the Lemelson MIT Prize of $500,000. This was the world's largest single prize for invention and innovation, and he also got the Turing Award. I think in the end, people wanted to.
Well, that's not bad. But at least he got something.
But he's 72 years old, and
He's now he's 82. He's 82 now. Currently, he's the director of his own company, the Bootstrap Institute, and that's where he's trying to basically bootstrap human intelligence with computers. He's refining a concept called collective IQ. Now, this is the thing. Bootstrap is housed rent-free in Logitech, the world's largest manufacturer of computer mice.
Yep.
Amazing.
So there we go, the story, the somewhat sad story of Douglas Engelbart.
And how we got to have the mouse.
And this is the best of Tech Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Hope you were paying attention because free food rides on our next segment. Stay tuned. This is the best of Tech Talk.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, 5 of the 30 occupations projected to grow the fastest by 2016 are IT-related, led by network and data communications analysts, software engineers, and systems analysts. 70% of business technology professionals surveyed by Information Week say there is a shortage of IT talent in the U.S. today. However, if you have previous military or management experience, there are tremendous opportunities for you in the IT field if you retrain. Stratford University's bachelor's degree in information technology prepares you to analyze, design, implement, administer, and secure computer networks and information systems. Master's degrees are also offered in information systems and software engineering. Day and evening classes are offered so you can continue in your current field. Call Stratford University at 800-444-0804 or visit online at stratford.edu. That's 800-444-0804. Stratford University, Tyson's Corner in Woodbridge.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
It's time for America's favorite new game show, the Stratford University Pop Quiz. Now, here's the host and star of our show. It's not Bob Barker. It's not Rosie O'Donnell. No, it's not Richard Dawson. It's Dr. Richard Schertz.
Nope, it's not him either. He's away today, so you're stuck with adjunct professor Jim Russ here in the virtual faculty lounge. And because you have the substitute teacher, you have kind of your choice of questions today. So if you get either one of these answers correct, you'll win the prize, which is tickets for two for fine dining at the Escoffier at Stratford University on the campus at Falls Church, Virginia, or Cafe Kareem, which is at the Woodbridge campus. There's also a campus in Richmond, and they're going to have a restaurant too, a sports bar, but not sure that's open yet. Anyway, if you know the answer to this question, either one of them, call me now, 877-936-9333. Once again, 877-936-9333. The question is, we were just talking about Douglas Engelbart, who was the guy that invented the XY position indicator, which we have since come to know as something else. What is the XY position indicator? That's question one. Question two is, what shape was it? If you know the answer to either of these questions, either or both of them, except you don't get two prizes if you know both of them, call me now, 877-936-9333, 877-936-9333. Once again, 877-936-9333. And because sometimes one of these isn't enough, it's time for
Profiles in IT Twinspin.
Now let's restart.
Wait a minute.
N-I-G.
All right. You know, you know, see, he's not paid to do that twice, Jim. Okay, there you go, Mr. Big Voice.
I'm having a bad day with the buttons.
Mr. Big Voice.
You know, it's like Groundhog Day. Didn't we do this already? And this is the point where David Byrd comes.
That's right.
Gone.
We're going to talk about Andrew Rubin. Now he's not the guy that did the Rubin sandwich.
Okay.
No, Andrew Rubin is a developer and the man behind the Android operating system for mobile devices. Of course, Google has released the Android cell phone and the Android tablet operating system, and he's the man behind it. Now, Mr. Rubin, as they call him, grew up in Chappaqua, New York.
There's a sandwich chain called Mr. Rubin, isn't there? Never mind.
Yeah. He was son of a psychologist who later founded his own direct marketing firm. I guess he could make more money that way. And he was actually sending out all sorts of email spam trying to sell electronic gadgets. So Rubin would try all these gadgets in the house. He had his whole bedroom filled with gadgets, so he kind of got tuned in, and he liked gadgets. That was kind of the beginning of his fascination.
A lot of our people start as gadget people, taking apart clocks and stuff like that.
That's right. He was playing around with all that stuff in his bedroom. Andy, as they called him, attended Horace Greeley High School in Chappaqua, New York. He earned a Bachelor of Science in Computer Sciences from Utica College in New York. Now, after college, he got a job with Carl Zeiss Corporation in Switzerland.
They're the people, they make great lenses, don't they?
Yeah, but he was into robotics. So he was a robotics engineer. Carl Zeiss went into robotics for manufacturing in particular. So he was a robotics engineer because he actually was into robots. He had a lot of robots in his bedroom. He was always, like, making robots. That was his, like, fascination.
There's so much you could say right now that I'm not going to.
Yes, right. No, I think it's better
if robots
you...
robots are the only thing. Never mind.
Yeah, I think we better not say any of that.
Yeah. Okay.
Jim. And so he moved to Switzerland, but he didn't stay there very long because he had a chance encounter in the Cayman Islands that brought him back to the U.S.
Better than I've done.
No, it's not that kind of encounter, Jim.
Okay.
Jim, let's go. Let's go to the straight and narrow. He was walking on the beach one early morning there in 1989 there at the Cayman Islands, and he ran across Bill Caswell sleeping on the beach. Now, Bill Caswell was an Apple employee. And the night before he'd been thrown out of his cottage when he had a fight with his girlfriend. So he was sleeping out on the beach.
Could be worse. He could have been in Juneau, Alaska.
Yeah,
he was
sleeping out on the beach. He had no blankets, nothing. And so Rubin said, look, Bill, you can stay with me. So then he gave Bill Caswell a place to stay, and they got to know each other, and Caswell offered him a job at Apple, which he accepted. So then he moved from Switzerland all the way back to Apple in 1989.
Wow.
Because of this guy that he met down in the Cayman Islands.
On the beach.
Yeah, I don't know anything more about the girlfriend or Caswell. Yeah, I don't know anything more about that. Now, but he was kind of a troublemaker, so he got to Apple. One of the first things he did, he reprogrammed the company's internal phone system, so whenever anybody would call internally, it would look on the caller ID as if they were getting a call from the CEO.
Nice. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's really smart, you know. Mm. That made the Apple CEO.
Yes, sir, I'm here. Oh, it's Fred of the mailroom.
That's right. Okay, 1990, this was the next year, Apple spun off a unit which was going to be developing handheld computing and communications devices. Now, this was sort of a precursor to the iPhone that actually failed. It was called General Magic.
Ah.
Do you remember General Magic?
I don't remember them at all either. General Magic.
Yeah, this was General Magic. So in 1990, it spun off. A couple of years later, Rubin, because he liked devices, decided to join them. And he was like a total immersion kind of guy. He liked to work around the clock. So he and several other engineers built loft beds over their desk.
Oh, my God.
So then he would work on his desk programming, and then at night he would climb up in the loft and sleep.
What is wrong with this? Do we need to go back to our discussion of geeks versus nerds?
No, I don't know.
I mean, this fits into the geek category, doesn't it?
Yeah. So you can see with this kind of life, you can see he probably didn't have any girlfriends. They're sleeping there in the loft above his desk.
Oh my God.
So there was a whole group of them worked together. Now they finished this operating system called a Magic Cap. And it was actually an operating system for mobile devices. But it was about 10 years ahead of its time. Just a handful of manufacturers and telecoms adopted it. And it never went anywhere. So Magic Cap failed and everybody just spread to the to the four winds. Yeah. So Rubin joined Artemis Research, which was founded by Steve Perlman, one of the guys at Magic Cap. Now, and he became a developer of the software behind Web TV. Remember Web TV?
Oh, yeah.
In 1999, Microsoft bought Web TV. And so, he didn't want to work for Microsoft. So he quit in 1999 after Microsoft bought Web TV. And he decided to do something on his own. So he rented a little retail store in downtown Palo Alto. He called it the laboratory, and he filled it up with, he brought all the robots from his bedroom and all of his gadgets. They had robots running around all over the place. And there was this one robot that looked like a robot in the movie that was like warning everybody that there was something around it, and it ran across the room saying, danger, danger, danger. And there was some movie that, I don't know what the name of the movie was, but they had this one robot would run around the place saying, danger,
wasn't
danger.
Wasn't that the danger warning Will Robinson thing from Lost in Space?
It could have been. Okay. I don't know where it was.
Sorry.
And so these guys decided that they would come up, they were trying to come up with an idea that would make them rich. They sat around here playing with their toys, trying to decide what to do. And they came up with an idea that they wanted to make it something that would cost less than $10 that would allow users to scan objects and perform an internet lookup. So you'd go into a store and you'd point the camera at the barcode. It would identify it, and then it would tell you about the object, how much it costs, where you could get it. It's kind of a good idea.
Yeah, it is.
So they got this idea. They were really excited about it. they had no money. And they couldn't get
How come that doesn't shock me?
And they couldn't get any VCs to buy on it. So they just said, okay, well, so what are we going to do? So then they decided to add a radio receiver and a transmitter to this thing. And they decided to name their company. So they called it, guess what? Danger Incorporated.
Oh, boy.
Danger!
Sounds pretty
danger.
Nerdy to me.
So they pitched it, and they called it an internet smartphone, you see,
mm-hmm.
because it was connected to the internet. It had a camera. It could read, barcodes, but it could also surf the web. And they called it the Sidekick. And actually, they got VC support for this.
Really?
Yeah, so they had their first bankroll. I don't think how much money they got. It wasn't too much, but they got their first bankroll. And so in early 2002, Rubin went to Stanford to give a talk on Sidekick. There are a couple of guys there. You may have heard of them. Larry Page and Sergey Brin. These
Can't
are the guys
say that, I have,
that started
no.
Google.
Oh.
These are the Google boys.
You haven't talked about them on Profile
yeah.
and IT.
No, I have. It was a long time ago.
Okay.
It was like 120. Maybe we should bring them back up again. Larry Page
yeah.
and Sergey Brin attended the lecture, and that was the first time they met Andy Rubin. And they were there. At that point, they had already started Google, but it hadn't gone public yet. And they looked at this little Sidekick, and the default search engine was Google. So they said, this is good. They liked it. And they made note of it. And it turned out that these guys both ended up getting a Sidekick. One of the carriers that had it was T-Mobile. So they had a T-Mobile Sidekick. They carried around with them, and then they would check how good the Google search engine was working.
Oh, wow.
And they would carry this around with them a lot. So this was their toy, the T-Mobile Sidekick. And so they sort of met Rubin back at that stage. They weren't even thinking about getting into the cell phone business. So this thing was moving along. Danger was moving along quite nicely. But you see, they got VC support. And the problem is, when you get VC support, the VCs want to get their payback.
Of course they
And
do.
If they don't think the CEO is enough of a businessman to get them the money back, you know what they do? They kick them out. They fire them. They bring in somebody else. So Rubin learned the hard way. He was ousted by the board because of the evil VC
influence.
Evil VC influence. This is from the developer point of view.
Right.
I mean, the VCs don't think they're evil.
They're just trying to make some money.
Yeah, they're just trying to make some money. So he quit. He was, licking his wounds. He didn't want to hang around there.
Yeah, he'd
been interested in this sort of mobile device thing for quite a while. So he used a domain name that he'd owned for several years called Android.com.
Mm-hmm.
And so he started a new business and assembled a small team of engineers from his previous activities, previous at Magic Cap and then at Danger, pulled together some of the top programmers, and they started working on a design of a handset, which was open to any and all software designers. Now, Mr. Rubin, Andy, spent all of his money on this project, and he didn't have much until he finally went broke. So he called his buddy, Mr. Perlman. Perlman was the guy that was funding and sort of the main push behind Magic Cap, and told him he was broke. And Perlman ultimately lent him around $100,000. Now, they took the idea of this mobile handset, which is open to any and all software designers, and they started shopping it to VCs. The VCs loved this idea. Now, this was the thing. They were going to write an operating system that was modular, and if a particular telecom wanted to use it, they would give him hooks into the operating system that he would pay for. They were called, you know, slices, or called razor slices or something. I forget the exact name. Mm-hmm. And he were selling access to the operating system, and that was his business model, which probably was not a very good business model, but it was a way to write a modular operating system. Well, Larry Page got wind of the fact that they were shopping this to VCs. He was still carrying around his little T-Mobile sidekick. He said, you know, I like this Andrew Rubin. And he says, our business model is probably better. They were making an open source operating system. Why don't we use open source as a way to get more people on the cell phone, and then we'll sell advertising. So before the VCs could fund this new project at Android.com, Google picked it up for an undisclosed sum in 2005. So you see it, but it goes all the way back to that original talk that he gave in 2002. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a history to it. See, I was curious. Nobody knew about Android when Google bought them. And I was curious as to what sort of the backroom intrigue that led to this was. And so this is kind of the story inside of the story. Now, he's currently, Andy's currently VP of Engineering at Google, and he's overseeing the development of the Android operating system. He's leading it, having a great time. Now, Rubin says the Google business model is the perfect match to Android, because you really open source is a distribution method, and then you make your money on advertising. He said he probably would have failed in his other business model selling access to the telecoms, because there's not a lot of big money at that. So he's actually quite happy. He just, I watched his briefing on the new Android 3.0, the honeycomb, and he just is having a ball, you know, this stuff. He's really happy there at Google. They've done a nice job with him. The guy just loves gadgets. So he's still single. I mean, I don't think he has a loft above his desk anymore. Like he has a retinal scanner at his front door. So if you walk up, and if the scanner recognizes you, the door just unlocks.
No woman would ever pay to put up with this.
No, but now he said this is very convenient, because if he has a problem with a girlfriend, he doesn't have to get back the key. He just changes the database entry. He just changes the database entry, and it won't unlock the door. Now, if it doesn't recognize you and you ring the doorbell, he has a robotic arm that lifts up, and it has a mallet, and it strikes this gong. So you're out there, and this big arm is striking the gong. It's a robotic doorbell.
Oh my God!
Which he just likes this kind of. He has robots running all over the house. He also had robots running around Apple, and there was one with webcams. And somebody hacked into it, and it was a big security problem, because these hackers were going all over in Apple with this thing. He's
look in the dictionary under geek.
Andrew Rubin, I think he's a happy guy, and I'm certain I think he's made quite a bit of money. Now there's a
probably
guy who followed his passion, and his passion led him to success.
There you go.
So there you go. Andrew Rubin, the developer behind the Android operating system.
This is the best of Tech Talk on Federal News Radio. You can hear us on 1500 AM in Washington, 820 AM in Frederick, also in Washington on 103.5 FM HD2, and in the Northern Virginia suburbs, 107.7 FM HD2. Here are a couple of websites to take note of. To learn more about Stratford University, you can go to stratford.edu. You can learn there about our next semester, the course offerings at Stratford, and all kinds of things about the university. Also, TechTalkOnline.com. Is your source for everything about this radio show. Most notably there, you can send us an email question, and that's how you can get to the doc. If you got any sort of technology question, send him a note there, and that's how he'll answer your question here on the air on Tech Talk Radio. You can also go back and listen to every single one of our Tech Talk shows and you can look at the outlines for each one of those shows and figure out where the topics are that you'd like to know more about. Again, stratford.edu for the university, and also for Tech Talk Radio, it's techtalkonline.com. We'll be back with more on Tech Talk right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University.
Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. The doc is away today. This is Jim Ross sitting in for him on the best of Tech Talk, and now it is time for us to take a trip into the kitchen.
Whipped cream is one of my favorite products. I put it on strawberries and ice cream all the time.
I put it on pizza.
Yeah, you put it on pizza. Okay, well, here's the thing. You can run a little experiment on whipped cream if you've got it at home. You can take a can of whipped cream out of the fridge, and then you can spray a generous amount on a spoon. But watch it carefully. It's very interesting. The whipped cream comes out, it flows out of the nozzle just like liquid. But the moment that it gets onto the spoon, it just sits there rigidly perched as though it were a solid. So it goes from a liquid, almost an apparent liquid state, to a solid state almost instantly.
Hey, Doc. What made it change?
Well, whipped cream performs a rapid change act because of a phenomenon called shear thinning. Now, this actually relates to some experiments that are being done at NASA, by the way. You know, NASA's really into whipped cream.
Maybe they're going to use it for the foam tiles on the shuttle or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Okay, when part of the foam is forced to slide or shear past the rest of the foam thins. You get kind of a shearing action. It becomes less like honey and more like water, allowing it to flow easily. Shear thinning occurs in many substances like ketchup, blood, motor oil, paint. For instance, extensive shear thinning in motor oil is unwanted because it reduces the oil's ability to protect engine wear. Shear thinning in paint allows it to shear off the brush but stay put on the wall. Shear spinning in ketchup allows the ketchup to flow out of the bottle but still sit on the French fry.
Gotcha.
So shear thinning occurs all the time. But the questions that science could not figure out, what's actually the physics behind shear thinning? And so NASA's been running an experiment. They have they launched an experiment on the space shuttle called Critical Viscosity of Xenon 2, CVX2. Now, xenon is very important because it's used in some of the lamps and ion rocket engines that NASA had. They needed to understand shear thinning, and it's a very simple thing to operate. And they noticed that if you go down to the critical point where it can operate both in two different states at the same time, liquid and vapor, that you are approaching a point where it behaves and shear thinning measurements can be done. So they went into outer space because you have to do the shear thinning experiments without gravity because gravity forces it to bunch down. And they put a paddle down in this xenon, which was at the near the critical point, and they measured variations in the pressure as they moved this paddle around, and they actually made direct measurements of shear thinning. The results that they exactly matched one of the models called the dynamic mode coupling theory. So now they've got a theoretical basis for shear thinning, and maybe they'll be able to make an improved whipped cream.
Wow.
So there you go. The physics of whipped cream.
I didn't know you could make whipped cream any better than it already was.
Well, I know.
That's amazing.
And I didn't understand how shear thinning worked until today.
Naveed, you're going to need to stay after class, my friend.
I know. Yeah. I know. I'm not going to let Naveed tell me any of his whipped cream stories.
No, let's move along. Oh, talk about... Oh, brother, my head's on fire now.
Now let's talk about the 10 most expensive domains. Mm-hmm. All right, now. I just want to jump and give Naveed a quiz. You know what the most expensive domain would be?
Running out of time here, Naveed.
No, I can't think of it.
Okay, well, the 10th most expensive one, this is in this top 10, is VIP.com. That sold for $1.4 million.
Mm-hmm.
Creditcard.com sold for $2.75 million in 2004. Wine.com is number 8, mm-hmm. sold for $2.9 million in September 1999. Shop.com sold for $3.5 million. Now, this sixth one on the list, I think, is really, really questionable. AsSeenOnTV.com.
Oh, that's a good one.
Sold for $5.1 million. Mm-hmm. Who's the idiot that bought AsSeenOnTV? He bought that in January 2000. That was the peak of the dot-com, just before the dot-com bubble burst.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Beer.com, I can understand that. Sold for $7 million. Diamonds.com sold for $7.5 million. Business.com sold for $7.5 million. Now let's go to the top two.
Yep.
Yeah, number two on the list, Porn.com.
How'd that happen?
Sold for $9.5 million. And the number one domain name on the internet, Sex.com.
Unbelievable.
Sold for $11 million or $14 million, kind of a disputed report. January 19th, 2006, it was bought by Escom Limited Liability Corporation. And so there you go. You want to know about domain names.
I'll make one observation. Looking at the domain names listed here, I can't imagine anyone ever actually typing those domain names into their URL bar and going there wanting to go there, because I'm not going to these sites right now, but I can imagine the only thing that's there is malicious software that's going to be loaded into your computer.
You're listening to the best of Tech Talk. This is Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, 820 AM, 107.7 FM HD2, 103.5 FM HD2. Stand by for our final segment right after this.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. More of Tech Talk Radio, presented by Stratford University, coming up in a moment.
My career was going nowhere.
College just wasn't working for me.
I was lost. Then I discovered Stratford University.
Stratford.
Stratford University. Stratford helped me take the skills I already had and turn them into a career.
I'm more of a hands-on learner, and I just couldn't make it in those large classes.
I finally knew I had to do something different.
With campuses in Tyson's Corner and Woodbridge, Stratford helps you earn your accredited degree in business administration, culinary arts, allied health, hotel and restaurant management, information technology, and hospitality management through day, evening, weekend, and online courses. And with 10-week sessions and rolling enrollments, you can jumpstart your new career when you're ready.
Now I'm on my way to a real career.
I love my classes and professors. Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford was exactly what I needed.
Stratford University. Just start it and we'll help you finish. For information, call 1-800-444-0804 or check us out on the web at stratford.edu. That's stratford.edu.
If it's technology, it's Tech Talk Radio. IT trends, software, the internet, and IT careers. Here's Dr. Richard Schertz of Stratford University with Tech Talk Radio.
Welcome back to the virtual faculty lounge at Stratford University. This is the best of Tech Talk.
Now it's time for the book of the week.
And this is quite a book.
Cooking for Geeks.
Mm-hmm.
I ordered this book from O'Reilly Publishing. They normally write programming books. So this is Cooking for Geeks, Real Science, Great Hacks, and Good Food by Jeff Potter. Now this is, and you can see these are some of the sections of the book. Think like a hacker. Now, you see, you just don't simply modify a recipe, you hack a recipe.
Aha. Uh-huh.
But to hack a recipe, you've got to understand the basic food chemistry, how it works, what you can substitute for, and so you've got to understand fundamentals of cooking in order to hack a recipe.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before you begin, Now, our chefs call it mise en place, preparing the space. He calls it initializing the kitchen. So how do you initialize the kitchen? Now, your inputs.
I'm afraid to ask.
Your inputs. Now, you see, your inputs to your item, the inputs are flavors and ingredients.
Right.
So inputs might be salt and pepper. It could be flour. Those are inputs. Now, what are your variables? Time and temperature.
Right.
So you got inputs, flavors, and ingredients, variables, time, and temperature.
It's starting to sound like a math equation.
I know. And then air, he's got a whole chapter on air, the baker's key variable. How do you put air into it to make it light and fluffy? And there are a number of ways to put air in your product. Air, the baker's key variable. So in the case of baking goods, air is the third variable. You have time, temperature, and the amount of air in it. And then, of course, you've got fun with hardware. So he has a whole section.
Oh boy!
On, he's got a whole section.
Wasn't
on,
that in our section about Quickie.com? Oh, no.
No, that was that you probably could look that up on Quickie.com.
I
haven't.
You could.
I haven't really checked all the possibilities on that site yet.
No.
Now, fun with hardware would be things like the specific heat of your pan and the conductivity of your pan to see what you have. He also talks about some techniques on. Culinary gastronomy, where you can use techniques, special techniques with special hardware to make unusual products. Now, I'm going to be giving over the next few weeks a few science lessons out of this book. I've really enjoyed reading this book. But
on the air?
On the air. I'll give on and off. I'm going to take some of the interesting things here. But today I'm going to just talk about one simple thing from this book.
Okay.
What's the difference between baking soda and baking powder?
There is a difference, and I don't remember. In the interest of time, I'll just let you tell us.
Okay, now see, baking powder baking soda first, is actually, it's a bicarbonate. It's sodium bicarbonate. Typically, it's sodium bicarbonate. It could be phosphorus bicarbonate, but it's a bicarbonate, and a bicarbonate is a base. And if you mix a bicarbonate with an acid, it forms CO2, plus a salt.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is you take, say, you could take sodium bicarbonate and you could drop it into lime juice and it's going to fizz.
Right.
In fact, baking soda is used to make these rockets where you actually have vinegar and baking soda and you have a small hole in the bottom of it and you put in the vinegar and then you turn it over and then drop the baking soda in it, and it just starts bubbling up and expanding, and it just shoots off.
Uh-huh.
So there are all kinds of, like, experiments with this. So that's baking soda, just bicarbonate. But what does it require to work? The food that you're cooking in has to have some acid in it.
Mm-hmm.
So if it has some lemon in it, if it's some acidic, it will work. If the food is not acidic at all, it will not work.
Mm-hmm.
So what you typically do with baking soda, you add baking soda, and then you see whether you get enough lift, whether you get enough acid to get enough lift. And if you don't get enough lift, you add more baking soda, until finally you get enough lift. Now, if there's so little acid in the recipe that it takes so much baking soda to get enough lift, it begins to taste salty because of all that sodium.
Aha. Uh-huh.
So then you know I have to use baking powder.
Aha. Uh-huh.
See, baking powder has the acid built into it. So if you take baking soda, you could add water, it won't do anything. You add acid, it foams.
Mm-hmm.
Baking powder, since it's got the acid as part of the product, you add water to it, it foams immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a product which is basic in nature and not acidic in nature, you have to use baking powder. So it depends on the ingredients.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really what you do. Baking powder is self-contained for CO2 generation when the ingredients are not acidic. So that's the difference between baking soda and baking powder. So baking powder has baking soda plus acid.
Interesting.
And there you go, right out of Cooking for Geeks.
So we're going to hear more out of this book in weeks
to
come.
We certainly are.
That's it for this week. More next week on The Best of Tech Talk.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news now.
This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Blueprint for Wealth, a program dedicated to securing your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. Now, here's your host, Wayne Zell.
Good morning and welcome to Blueprint for Wealth. I'm Wayne Zell, your host of this very fast-paced half hour of special topics and special guests that are designed to help you realize your personal dreams of wealth and freedom. The show is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Peddle.